You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 1st, 2006. This is Stephen Novella, your host, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me tonight are Perry DeAngelis.
Righto.
Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone.
And Bob Novella.
Good evening.
So I was sitting in my office yesterday in front of my laptop, which is connected to the Internet, and guess who Skyped me out of the blue?
Couldn't imagine.
George Bush.
No, not quite. Our friend, the amazing Randy, James Randy.
No, no way.
So
you made a friend for life.
did he miss dial?
No, actually, what he told me was he just got back from the TAM4, the amazing meeting.
Right.
They had an excellent meeting, you know, almost maximum capacity attendance, which I think is about, he said, 600. Said the lectures were incredible. It went off without a hitch, and he was basically just glowing from the wonderful meeting, and he wanted to talk to somebody about it, about how good the meeting was.
No way.
So, of course, he thought of me.
Good man.
Of course he did. Of course.
Actually, what he said was I was the only one in his address book who was online, but...
Yeah, that'll do.
You'll say, right? What were you, the fifth person he tried?
Right place at the right time.
So, no, it was fun. It was good to talk to James about it. It was good. But
did you record it?
No, I don't have the recorder at work on my laptop. I did not record it. But we talked about the meeting a bit. The... one thing of interest is that, you know, they do make a DVD of the video of all of the lectures. So you can...
Oh, wow.
He said in a few weeks they should have the DVD for the meeting available. I noticed the DVDs for previous year's meetings are for sale on Randy's website, www.randy.org. So keep an eye out for that. Hopefully we'll be able to get to one of these meetings in the future. But they're definitely taking off. He said the attendance is increasing every year. They're definitely going to look for a bigger venue next year.
That's what he said.
So congratulations to Randy and the JREF for a conference. Well done.
Here, here.
Other news items, just to get us started. Evan, you sent me this one. And Vatican may have found Pope John Paul's miracle. So in order to become a saint, you know, within Catholic tradition, one of the criteria is that you have to have, I think, is it three verified miracles attributed to the individual that's up for sainthood. And there are those who think that Pope John Paul II should be considered for sainthood, and now they are touting his alleged first miracle, which, interestingly... is a young nun who was afflicted apparently with Parkinson's disease. Now, Parkinson's disease is a neurological disorder. It is a disorder, in fact, that Pope John Paul II suffered from himself. You may have noticed that, you know, in the last 10 years or so of his life, he was fairly hunched over. He didn't move very much. You may have even noticed he had a tremor. That was his Parkinson's disease. And it was very, very advanced by the time he died. Well, apparently, upon his death, a nun who was afflicted with Parkinson's disease, you know, prayed to him and was allegedly cured of her Parkinson's disease.
That's interesting. You think God misdirected the cure there?
I don't know. I mean, you know, it is interesting that, you know, you would think that that God would cure or heal a nun of the same disease and not deign to heal the Pope himself, but. So the church thinks it worthy of investigation. They haven't declared it a miracle. They just think their preliminary investigation has determined that they think that it deserves a further looking into.
You think they'll consult neurologists and other...
I don't know. I mean, they said that they consulted physicians, but, you know, who knows... how skeptically trained they were. Just being a physician is not enough to assess an apparent miracle.
Are you aware of Parkinson's spontaneous remission cases, Steve?
Well, you know, Parkinson's is a syndrome. It's just a constellation of signs and symptoms that could have many causes. So If you're talking about specifically Parkinson's disease, which is caused by, you know, death of a certain population of brain cells, no, there are no spontaneous remissions. But you could theoretically have Parkinsonism, the symptoms of Parkinson's disease, induced by, say, a drug or a toxin, and when the effect of that drug goes away, the symptoms can get better. So it depends on specifically what her diagnosis was. It's also possible she didn't even have Parkinson's disease or Parkinsonism. You know, sometimes people are prematurely and incorrectly given that diagnosis because they have some other kind of tremor or some other symptom which is due to something else. So always with these miracle cases, you have to, or cases with an apparent healing, whether it's a faith healing or whatever, unless you objectively document that the disease alleged to have been cured actually existed in the first place, you know, the remission doesn't really mean anything. So, again, I don't know to what extent the medical history was established in this case.
There's such a powerful motive for fraud.
Pious fraud, yeah, pious fraud. Absolutely. So, you know, certainly, you know, I don't think I would put any credence on it unless it was exquisitely documented. And then all you could say was there was an apparent spontaneous remission, which, again, does happen sometimes in certain diseases. And if it were a case of Parkinson's that spontaneously remitted, I think all we could say was, well, whatever was causing that was not dead brain cells. It was something. It must have been something else that is amenable to spontaneous remission.
Well, I think we can lend a hand here in deciding whether or not this was a true miracle, because the very last sentence of the article, at least the one I'm reading here, yahoo.com, the last sentence reads, "The experts must rule out any natural explanation for the recovery before a miracle can be certified."
Right.
I'd say that, Steve, certainly you could lend yourself to that, explaining the natural remission or...
If the case was documented adequately ahead of time, if there weren't adequate documentation of her medical condition beforehand, it may not be possible at this point in time to say definitively what happened. So basically it all depends on the documentation.
Yeah, man, at least the Catholic Church in the past has demonstrated a reasonable degree of rigor when verifying these sorts of things.
Yeah, right. I mean, they are fairly conservative. They do not want to prematurely label something as miraculous. Then they're often... officially, they will withhold that designation even when there's popular belief that a miracle has occurred. But, you know, again, they are a religious institution. They are the Catholic Church. They will, in some cases, say that a miracle occurred even short of what, you know, skeptics would consider scientific proof.
Yeah, well, their belief system presupposes a supernatural world.
Of course.
So this will be the first of the three miracles that they're trying to attribute. I wonder what the next two are going to be.
Well, we can only wait and see. Well, they haven't established this one yet, so we won't get ahead of ourselves. But the next thing that happened this week that is of interest was the Bush's State of the Union address. Perry, I know you're always, you know, enwrapped with these things. You follow the political news very closely. You saw the State of the Union address?
Indeed. I did indeed. I thought it was a fine performance by our chief executive last night. There was a possibility of some controversy there when Mrs. Sheehan showed up, invited by some congresspeople, but she was escorted out for having a derogatory T-shirt about the war. They also escorted out another woman who had a positive T-shirt about the war. So,
well, at least they were balanced.
They were trying to be consistent. Indeed, they were. It's a very dignified, important speech. So you have to be very careful about who you let in. But on the whole, I thought it was a good speech. But
the thing that caught our interest, you know, skeptically, not a purely political issue, was his call for increased science education.
Indeed.
So at least, you know, again, what this will lead to in concrete, practical terms remains to be seen. At least at the federal level, presidents have a long history of good speechifying about education, but then not really doing much about it.
Right.
Although Bush is the one president, you know, he did pass No Child Left Behind. You know, for good or for ill, he actually shifted control from the states to the federal government with regards to education. So again, regardless of what you think about the effectiveness of that policy, he is trying to do something at the federal level. And now he is calling for increased a 22% increase in clean energy research. So again, more funding of research there, and in general, more support for both education, both science and math. So we'll see. I mean, this kind of efforts did, I think, actually lead to improved education, as I believe we discussed in the last episode following Sputnik.
There was certainly a great deal made about his call for clean energy and the attempt to make us less oil dependent.
Right.
He being from Texas, and the general the conventional wisdom being that he is in the pocket of big oil.
Right.
So
right.
It was duly noted today and much discussed. His seeming to break away from that.
Well, again, we'll see if anything concrete comes of it. Certainly endorse an increase in overall support for science education, but it's got to be done in the right way. Again, we had this conversation during the last episode. Just throwing money at the problem, I don't think is going to help. Well, let's move on to your emails and questions. We actually had quite a busy week in terms of getting email from listeners to the show. One email harkens back to an episode we did in September discussing the 9/11 conspiracy theories. If you guys recall, the issue came up that when the hijackers hijacked the jetliners, the first thing they did was turn off the transponders. And we speculated as to why is it even possible to turn off a transponder in a cockpit that seems like a security hole. Well, a pilot and engineer, Glenn Barless, who is a recent but avid listener to our podcast, wrote us this email. He writes, "I am listening to your podcast to catch up with your shows, and I'm up to September 2005. Enjoy it very much. The 9/11 conspiracy show had a brief discussion of the aircraft transponder and a question as to why it can be turned off in the cockpit. As a pilot and electrical engineer, I can tell you there are very good technical reasons why this is necessary. I responded to him, well, can you tell us what those technical reasons might be? And he obliged with a rather long answer, but I'll hit the highlights. He says basically that, how transponders work. They send out a radar signal, basically, which not only greatly enhances the radar profile of an airplane. Small airplanes may be almost invisible by air traffic controller radar, but their transponders make them very visible. It also can send out a 4-digit identification number and also can transmit specific codes that give information about the flight. For example, the code 1200 means that the plane is flying on VFR, which is basically flying by radar. And then 7500 means hijacking in progress. 7600 means loss of two-way radio communication. 7700 means airborne emergency. So that's how transponders work. He said that it's necessary to be able to turn off the transponder because if you couldn't turn off the transponder, then all of the airplanes that were taxiing on the runway or in various stages of being in the airport itself would be blasting away their transponder signals and would be completely flooding, the air traffic control tower in the airport with signals that they don't need to see. So, in fact, the last thing they do before takeoff is to switch the transponder on. And they turn it off soon after landing. In addition, of course, they need to turn it off at times to reserve its battery in order to do maintenance, et cetera, et cetera. So basically, his point was there are times when you have to turn it off. So that answered a question that we left unanswered from that previous podcast.
That's great when our listeners call in and, educate us on these things. Certainly we don't know all the details about a lot of these things. It's really great that they chime in and give us their two cents.
Absolutely. Yeah, occasionally things come up that we didn't have a chance to look up or just none of us happened to know. So thanks to Glenn Barless for giving us that information.
Thank you, Glenn.
We got another email. Now, last episode, we had an email by an individual who didn't sign his full name, but did his email contained the initials RC, so I've been referring to him as RC, who took exception to Darwinian evolution, essentially thought that it was unproved and that scientists had faith in the origin of life. not only did we discuss it on the show, but I sent him a written response, which is included in our notes page for the show. Well, RC wrote back. He wrote back a fairly long response, and again, I can't read the entire thing, but I'll hit some of the highlights. For example, he wrote, "If God created the universe and all that's in it, he did so the way he felt like doing, and that includes evolution, or in his italics, or the appearance of evolution."
Right.
So that captures a very common belief among creationists that, well, any evidence you find for evolution could be explained on the basis that God made the earth to appear as if it evolved. The problem with that, of course, is that those notions are untestable. They're outside the realm of science. In fact, you can use that logic to say that the world is the way it is, not because of some fact of nature, but because God arbitrarily made it that way. You can use that, you can apply that to anything in science, literally any scientific claim.
This is an old, old argument.
Yeah, it's very, very old. It's
yeah.
very old. And it's just logically, it's irrelevant. Yeah, sure, God could have made the entire universe 5 seconds ago to appear exactly as if it evolved naturally over 15 billion years in every way. There's absolutely no scientific way to prove or disprove that idea. It is simply outside the realm of science. Science can only be agnostic towards such notions. And that's he talks a lot about this idea. I think that just captures it, but he didn't quite understand that point. That, you know, we're not saying that we can prove scientifically or that science rules out that God played a hand in this, just that you have to state it within a testable scientific way. And notions like God created the world to appear as if it evolved, or that you can't prove that God didn't will life to form, you know, through natural processes or whatever, the scientists don't say that. Science just doesn't deal with those questions at all. It can't. The other point is it's not by choice. It's not that science chooses to exclude supernatural explanations, as some ideas falsely claim. Science, by its very nature, can't deal with supernatural explanations because it simply doesn't fit into the process, the logic of science.
And even if it did, Steve, it's...
Yeah.
If science did that, science would essentially be closing the book on that type of inquiry, because there's your ultimate answer. You know, science typically creates lots more questions when it delivers an answer. And if we did that, you'd just be closing these books on research and be like, oh, there it is, there's the answer. Where how much further can you go than that?
Exactly. Whenever you get to the point where God did it, you can't go beyond that. There's no place to go. There's no further questions to ask. Science ends.
It's the ultimate god of the gaps.
Right. It's the god of the gaps. In fact, I used that the god of the gaps explanation in the podcast last week and in my response to him. And in his reply, he acknowledged that concept and said, "I'm not trying to employ the god of the gaps." But he went on to say that he thinks that the idea that gaps in science are shrinking is false. He did not buy into that. He said that when science answers questions, that begets a lot more questions. Again, he sort of missed the point a bit. That is true. I think as we learn more about the world, every time we answer a question, it usually spawns a bunch of new questions. In fact, the best ideas in science are ones that create even more questions. However, the size of these questions do shrink over time. I use, for example, the field of genetics. In the beginning, the first part leading up to the middle of the 20th century, we discovered that not only can traits be inherited, they're inherited as discrete units. That was Mendel's discovery, that these units correlate to genes, and that DNA is the substrate of the genetic code of inherited information. Those are big knowledge gaps that were filled definitively and forever. Those facts will never change. that also spawned hundreds of subsequent questions about genetics, which were answered, which spawned thousands of still smaller questions about you. So we are now looking at very tiny, minute questions with regard to specifically how genes work, how they're transcribed, et cetera, et cetera. But there's nothing even close to the scope of the fact that DNA exists. So that's what we mean by shrinking gap. It's sort of the scope and the implications of the questions that we're asking are getting smaller and smaller, narrower and narrower as the big questions get answered. With the fossil record, it's actually a little bit more literal. If you look at the morphological distance between two related species, that is a morphological gap that has to be filled evolutionarily. There had to be something between them. As we find a fossil that lies morphologically between these two species, that creates two smaller gaps. The number of gaps actually increases every time we find a transitional fossil, but the size of those gaps shrinks. So that's a little bit, I think, easier to see visually, but it's the same exact concept. Again, I can't go into everything that he wrote because it takes a little bit too long, but just one final thing. He mentioned as, again, a gap that evolutionary scientists have not filled, the notion of, he writes specifically, take the relationship that exists between bees and flowers. Bees depend on flowers for honey. Flowers depend on bees for reproduction. How did this relationship develop? And he essentially says that scientists have no answer for this question. Well, frankly, he needs to read more, you know, about evolution. I mean, natural scientists have written about coevolution extensively. There's extensive writing about the notion of coevolution. It absolutely has been addressed head-on by natural scientists with really good questions, with really good answers. But I think the key misconception in his question is this: flowers depend on bees for reproduction. That is not true.
Not true.
Flowers, and especially if you think about, you know, millions of years ago, the precursors to modern flowering plants, they didn't depend upon insects for reproduction. They have their genetic material and pollen that gets spread either to themselves or to other plants. And they can spread by wind, they can spread by direct contact, they can get rubbed up against by animals, you know, maybe they get rubbed up against by insects. But they don't need any one of these things to reproduce. They could reproduce without it. But if an insect started to exploit pollen as a food source, that would create a new mechanism to spread the pollen, and it may, in fact, be more efficient than the other methods. So plants that tended to attract insects to their pollen would reproduce more quickly and would therefore evolutionarily outcompete their competitors. Bees are now using the food to survive. Again, they must have been eating something else before pollen existed, but they started to exploit pollen because it was there. It was a free food source. So that started selective pressures to become better at getting and living off of pollen, selective pressures for flowering plants to be more attractive to insects and become more efficient at using them to spread their pollen, and there you have this dance of coevolution.
Yeah, Steve, it doesn't take too much imagination to imagine a scenario where that could happen. This reminds me a little bit of intelligent design, where it's kind of like, you know, the half tractor thing, all or nothing.
Yeah,
it's not all or nothing. I mean, you could imagine, you know, flowers and bees just like easing into their dependence on each other. It's not like bam, from day one you've got to be fully dependent. I mean, it probably took, you know, 500,000 years before that to fully evolve or more. So it's not an all or nothing thing.
No, absolutely. I think the other sort of misconception that people who are not familiar with naturalism, you know, and evolutionary theory have is that animals have a very narrow set of behaviors that they do. That animals do one thing that they're absolutely dependent upon. Certainly some animals are, but the animals that are very narrow in their behavior and in the food that they eat are destined for to become extinct and to not leave any descendant species. A lot of species, however, are fairly, they're what we call generalists. They they might exploit a variety of foodstuffs. They might occasionally engage in behavior that's different than their typical behavior. Predators will occasionally scavenge. Animals which eat fruit may occasionally eat other plants or occasionally eat meat even. So there's a lot more variability in animal behavior than a lot of people think, and that variability always allows for the foot in the door for a new, engaging in a new behavior, which leads a species down a new sort of evolutionary path. Again, I think RC is being reasonable. He is at least trying to argue sensibly and logically. He's not just attacking us or making crazy statements, so we certainly appreciate that. But I think he just has some gaps and misconceptions in his knowledge of evolution and would do well just to pick up a couple of non-hostile sort of evolutionary textbooks. We do have one more email, but it does lead into a topic that we are going to be discussing with a special guest that we have tonight. So let's go to that guest now. So joining us now is Tara Smith. Tara, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. So Tara, just to give a little bit of background, is a PhD in, you said, epidemiology. Is that correct?
PhD is in microbiology.
In microbiology, and you have a specialty in infectious disease?
Yes.
And you are currently an assistant professor at the University of Michigan?
Of Iowa.
Of Iowa.
Michigan
okay.
was my postdoc work.
And postdoc at Michigan.
Yes.
And you, several months ago, you tell me, you founded a group called the Iowans for Science. Tell me a little bit about that.
Just a group, mostly people who have been concerned about evolution and science being taught properly in our schools. So we've just kind of gotten together, really haven't made a lot of progress yet, but just getting together and doing some chatting about how to properly teach science in Iowa and how to teach it not only to students but also to get the public interested and to have them understand what the controversies are
right,
in science right now.
That's
great. A noble cause.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's happens to be the mission of the New England Skeptical Society as well. So we are brothers in arms, as it were.
Definitely.
Tara, you have a distinction on the Skeptic's Guide. You are, in fact, the first female voice ever to be recorded on this show.
I guess so.
Sorry to say, the ranks of skepticism are rather bereft of women.
Yes, I've noticed that before.
So we definitely need more like you in the movement.
Well,
never thought about that, Steve. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, absolutely.
The first female we've ever had on the show.
Well, the first female skeptic.
First female skeptic. You were right.
That's true.
That's right.
We had a psychic.
We had a psychic on.
Oh, did you?
Jan Helen McGee.
That's right. You were right, Evan. I found you through your blog, Etiology, which has the British spelling, A-E-T.
Yes.
I-O-L-O-G-Y, where you guess you write about all things scientific and skeptical, it seems. Let's get to the email that led me to your blog. This was sent to us through the Ask the Skeptic section of the NES website. Unfortunately, the person who sent it did not deign to sign it, so it's from from Anonymous. It's a bit rambling, but let me just read the part that we're interested in here. He writes, discuss why the basic criterion, scientific proof, in scare quotes, of AIDS has never been met. The requirement that HIV-1 RNA transcribed, cloned, replicated, and retransmitted in the lab has never occurred. Yet you still accept the scientific dogma as scientific fact. Belief that some marker exists to test the current blood supplies for a disease that cannot be replicated. It's a very incoherent email. But within it, I see some glimpses of more coherent tracks that I've read about HIV denial. Basically, people who deny that the human immunodeficiency virus causes the disease AIDS.
Right.
He also writes later on about using treatments to treat autoimmune diseases. Here we go. Why would you inject toxic chemicals into a patient which would destroy the immune system to cure an autoimmune disease? So he makes the common misconception that AIDS is an quote unquote autoimmune disease.
Right.
I actually hear people sometimes refer to the autoimmune system, which always cracks me up. some science fiction show made that gaffe recently. Like, oh my God, the autoimmune system, come on. So AIDS, of course, as we know, is an immunodeficiency disease, not an autoimmune disease.
Yes.
And we don't use immunosuppressive therapy to treat it. In fact, the treatment, if anything, is designed to support the immune system. Okay. So you had written on your blog about the story of Christine Maggiore. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, this is a woman. She was diagnosed with as being HIV positive roughly a decade ago. So she started out as, you know, an HIV activist working to educate people. And then she heard about the ideas of a professor named Peter Duisberg.
Right.
And he's been kind of the most prominent of the HIV deniers, you know, since the beginning. And so she came to look further into his writings and decided that he was correct. HIV didn't cause AIDS, and, you know, everyone had been misled. There was this whole conspiracy, and it was really drugs that were causing AIDS, and she had nothing to fear by being HIV positive.
Mm-hmm.
So along the way, she ended up getting married and having two children. During her pregnancy, she did not take any, you know, antiretroviral drugs, didn't take AZT, and then, even worse, she breastfed both of her children,
right,
which has been known to, you know, increase the probability of transmitting the HIV virus to the babies. So last year, her three-year-old daughter, Eliza Jane, died of what was found to be pneumocystis carini, an organism that is often found in people who are immunosuppressed and very, very commonly found in AIDS patients. She has since hired her own kind of team of experts to refute these, you know, the coroner's findings and say, no, her daughter didn't die of AIDS. She died of anaphylactic shock, a reaction to the antibiotics that were given to her.
Mm-hmm.
So she's kind of been on this whole crusade and really just miseducating people about AIDS. And
right.
In the meantime, you know, she lost her own daughter to it.
Right, and, you know, it seems as if she's, you know, too emotionally wrapped up in her position now to really look at it logically or reasonably.
Yeah, absolutely. She went on a TV show, you know, one of those 60 Minutes or Dateline or something like that a couple months ago and, you know, said she still denies that HIV causes AIDS, that her daughter died of AIDS. They showed her pictures of, you know, pneumocystis in her daughter's lungs. They showed her stains of her daughter's neurons that were infected with HIV. She had HIV encephalitis.
Mm-hmm.
She still didn't believe them. So she just, you know, it's just the doctors are biased against her. And
right. Yeah, once you're in the land of bias and conspiracy, evidence is irrelevant.
Did she think that the Tara? Did she think that the pictures were faked or doctored or not of her child?
She didn't say. She just said she didn't buy it.
Okay.
Not right.
Just, you know, just no reason for it. Just she didn't believe it.
Okay.
Now, I note from reading, you know, a lot of the literature about this phenomenon that, you know, the whole HIV denial phenomenon sort of picked up steam in the late 80s and through the 90s. But then the protease inhibitors came on the market. Now, protease inhibitors are the newer treatments, the newer antiretroviral treatments that kill and stop the AIDS virus from replicating in the body. And they were, you know, pretty darn effective. And people with AIDS started living, you know, much, much longer. It really started to become more of a chronic disease than a terminal disease. And the HIV deniers kind of denial subsided a bit. But now it's making a resurgence. And have you noticed that? And what would you attribute that to?
I mean, it's hard to say. It's nothing new as far as their arguments. You know, they're the exact same thing that Duisberg has said from the beginning. I mean, so a lot of it is recycled. They don't educate themselves on the literature. They don't know what's been, you know, what's been found since the early 90s when all of this was originally published.
Right.
You know, so they're, it's just a lot of people kind of wanting to believe what, you know, their friends tell them and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's also, you know, the fact that these people are living longer is almost a problem too. You know, they see these people that are HIV positive, but yet they're living longer lives. They seem healthy, so obviously the virus must not be causing the disease then. So it's almost as if some of those treatments have backfired by showing that people can live longer lives even though they're HIV positive.
Right. It's interesting. I mean, I think it's there's no belief so insane or ridiculous that there aren't you know, tons of people who are willing to flock to its belief. Mm-hmm. This is a good example of that. You would think, you know, why deny that HIV causes AIDS? You know, where mm-hmm. does that come from? But I think once the notion takes hold, it just takes on a life of its own. Now you have essentially, you know, just a couple of people are really all that's necessary to push the idea forward. And once you start, you know, surrounding it in all the usual emotional trappings, there's a government conspiracy against us, mm-hmm. and the pharmaceutical companies are conspiring to yep. just to make money, and just people are so sort of ready and willing to believe those notions. The actual mm-hmm. scientific details are irrelevant.
Yep,
I think it's really that just those are the emotional appeals that are driving this.
And I mean, sometimes it is also people either in the scientific field or in the media kind of overstate things, you know.
Right.
There's still this idea that AIDS is automatically a death sentence. You know, you're infected with HIV, you're going to die, and you're going to die soon. But, you know, we know that now that some people do seem to be resistant to the virus. There are
right.
certain genetic mutations that will lead them to, you know, for whatever reasons we really don't understand clearly yet, you know, they don't seem to develop AIDS, or else it would take them a very, very long time for them to do that. So,
right.
So there's some backlash against that, too. You know, well, if AIDS is such a death sentence, you know, then why am I still healthy 10 years later, even though I haven't taken drugs? So there's a lot of that, too, that, you know, kind of a black box right now for the scientific community. We really don't know why some of these people are living longer and not needing drugs to stave off their infection. And so they take hold of that.
That's a good point. Basically, and again, you compare this to other denial phenomena, Holocaust denial, evolution mm-hmm. denial, there's mental illness denial, they employ the same logical strategies. And what you're alluding to is the fact that, you know, reality is complicated. It's complex.
Yeah.
Medicine is very, very complicated. And what the deniers survive on is all of the details, the sort of apparent inconsistencies and the complexity that any yeah. discipline like this necessarily creates. So, yeah, sure, some people live longer than others with the virus, whether they're treated or not treated. And we don't know everything about, you know, how the what the cycle of the HIV viruses, there may be co-infecting factors. Yeah, there's legitimate, right. you know, sort of discussion and debate about a lot of the details.
Uh-huh.
Just like, you know, creationists talk about arguments that evolutionists have about the details of evolution. And
mm-hmm.
they turn that into doubt about the basic core facts that, you know,
exactly.
the correlation between HIV and AIDS is overwhelmingly demonstrated with multiple mm-hmm. independent lines of evidence. So it is a good example of the denial phenomenon in general, and it's kind of a little bit more of a tangible topic than, say, something huge like evolution.
Uh-huh.
So that's why I found it very fascinating to look at it. You really can learn a lot about how the logic that they employ.
No, absolutely. I mean, and when you take them, you know, like AIDS denial and evolution denial, and you put their methods side by side, I mean, it's striking how much they're the same.
Yeah.
You know, they use the gaps in the literature, and they use, you know, they take a quote from a scientist that says, you know, we don't understand this phenomenon, and then they take that out of context and, you know, just quote mine that and say, oh, well, look, they don't understand this. This means they're completely wrong, you know.
Right.
So they have a lot of these same methods. You know, they appeal to experts. They have, you know, Najori founded a group called Alive and Well, and on her board of advisors is Duisberg, who is, you know, a PhD, and he's a member of the National Academy of Sciences.
Right.
So he's someone, you know, who looks respectable, even though the rest of his ideas are rather
nutty,
crazy.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he also, in addition to AIDS denial, he denies that the human papillomavirus causes cervical cancer. He denies that prions cause, you know, mad cow disease. You know, anything that he can deny, it seems like he wants to get in on the ground floor there. So, but they take these, you know, people who are supposed to be experts and put them, you know, align them with their group, and so then they can say, hey, look at this guy who's, you know, won accolades in his field, and he agrees with us, so we must be right.
They make the argument from authority,
mm-hmm.
But they invest in authority in an individual scientist,
right.
which is quirky, as opposed to the scientific community, where individual quirkiness should sort of work itself out in some sort of
right.
consensus.
Yes.
Yeah, I do think that the similarities between, you know, evolution denial, creationism, intelligent design, and HIV denial are striking. I did, in fact, a few years ago, I wrote an article about just that on skepticism and denial.
You?
Yeah, it's on my website. But it also compares it to mental illness denial and Holocaust denial, saying, so what are the common logical threads among them, and you pointed out a lot of them. Some other ones that I think come to the foreground are the moving goalpost syndrome, the idea that no matter how much evidence emerges, it's not enough. With creationists, of course, doesn't make it, no matter how many transitional fossils we find, it's never enough.
There's always more gaps.
There's always more gaps. With HIV denial, what I find that they do is, again, so 10 years ago, one of the big points of the HIV deniers was, how come with all of the HIV drugs that are being given to patients, how come patients with AIDS aren't living longer? Now, 10, 15 years later, they're living dramatically longer, but that's not enough now. That evidence, that additional piece of evidence is no longer enough. So they just sort of migrate over to some other, you know, claim that's not being met. Well, you can't prove that the virus is actually killing the immune cells. Or that there isn't some other infectious agent that's also present. You can always point to something we don't know, because we never know everything down to the last dot and tittle, as they say.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, it's I won't say funny. It's not really funny. It's almost sad. But you know, the thing is that you can do that with any infectious disease. You know, you have take influenza. You know, many more people are infected than are symptomatic. So, you know, just because you're not seeing the same symptoms in everyone, that certainly doesn't mean that, you know, the influenza virus doesn't cause that disease. And they hold you know, HIV up to this higher standard than they do any other infectious disease.
Mm-hmm.
You know, really, if you took their arguments to their logical end, you'd just be denying the whole germ theory.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, sometimes they do fall into that trap, like, you know, the evolution deniers. In order to deny evolution, they really have to deny all historical sciences. And in essence, they end up doing that. They deny any ability to investigate history, whatever it is, in a scientific way. And the same thing with the HIV deniers. You end up denying really all of infectious disease. And then, you know, even by logical extension, all of medicine. I mean, you know, it's really the same logic and evidence that we use to base, you know, all medical practice on. And there's, you know, roughly the same degree of uncertainty. And in fact, there's often less uncertainty in these topics. I think that the whole HIV hypothesis is one of the better well-established hypotheses in medical science.
Mm-hmm.
There are certainly other fields that are even for which the evidence is less clear.
Oh, definitely.
What would you guess at as a motive for this particular denial, either of you, Steve or Tom?
I mean, it depends on which group you're talking to. There are still, you know, people like Philip Johnson and Jonathan Wells of the Discovery Institute who also deny HIV. And, you know, they're more on the religious right. You know, they don't want to see AIDS as a viral disease that, you know, anyone is susceptible to. They want to see it as a lifestyle disease that, you
God's
know, it's these
wrath.
Marginalized people, it's the homosexuals, it's the prostitutes, you know,
mm-hmm.
drug users, they're getting what they deserve for their behavior, essentially, is their, you know, their argument. But, you know, with this new crop of kind of left-wing, almost, HIV deniers, the rock stars and, you know, the old ACT UP group in San Francisco and, you know, Matt Giori's group, I mean, it just seems really rooted in that anti-government, distrust, conspiracy theory type of thing. You know, we don't trust the government. We don't trust the pharmaceutical companies. We want everything to be natural and not putting anything toxic in our bodies. So these AIDS drugs are toxic. Therefore, they must be actually causing AIDS instead of the virus.
Right.
So.
It's just an anti-authoritarian, new age kind of ideology on the left. And religious nuts on the right, which is true basically of all alternative medicine, is that you get those same two groups. You get sort of either the anti-regulation or sort of religious people on the right, and you get the new age anti-authoritarians on the left. And so there's sort of broad political support for things like alternative medicine. And I also notice a lot of correlation between that and HIV.
Mm-hmm.
HIV denial. It goes hand in hand with a lot of sort of touting natural remedies, et cetera.
Yep, and in Maggiore's book, she released a book and, you know, talks about that, about, you know, homeopathy and all these different kind of herbal treatments and, you know, acupuncture and, I mean, just anything other than, you know, quote-unquote Western medicine to treat this.
Well, so let's move off this topic a little bit. I'm interested in the Iowans for Science. It sounds like evolution is the primary topic that you guys cover. Have you dabbled in anything else, either pseudoscientific or paranormal?
Not yet. Evolution was kind of the main impetus because we do have Guillermo Gonzalez. He's a fellow with the Discovery Institute on the faculty at Iowa State University. He's the author of The Privileged Planet, which is a book and video that's been out recently. So he's kind of made a lot of noise in Ames, Iowa. So that was kind of the main thing is that we wanted to kind of get a group together to, you know, show our solidarity really against that kind of thing being taught as science in Iowa. So that was the reason for trying to get a coherent group together for this.
Yeah, but you know, Tara, that creationism is a gateway topic to full-fledged skepticism.
Uh-huh,
it often leads scientists into the full spectrum of skeptical activity. It, in fact, was the first topic that really got me interested in skepticism myself. Because, again, even at high school, you know, evolution was one of my favorite topics within the realm of science. And I just became fascinated, like this morbid fascination with creationism. I mean, how could you deny the facts that are so abundant and so apparent? And you know, how could someone's logic be so tortured? And now here I am heading a skeptical society. So you know, it'd be interesting to see what your group evolves into. I mean, I think that once you develop the tools of evaluating pseudoscience, of identifying logical fallacies, of the abuse and misuse of science, you'll find that they apply to any pseudoscientific topic.
Oh, definitely.
Anyone. We frequently get emails about a variety of topics that we write about, you know, UFOs, crop circles, it doesn't matter. And almost literally, you can use like a form letter response and just copy in whatever topic it is that they're talking about into the form letter. And it would perfectly suffice to respond to the comments that these people are making. It doesn't matter.
Because they're failures of reason and logic. It's not the specifics of their particular holy cow that are at issue.
Yeah. Right.
It's their ability to reason.
God, it's the same ones over and over and over and over again. I mean, it really does seem to be just a tendency of human thought. You know, this is sort of the low common denominator, the pathway of least resistance for our thoughts to take, unless you have, you know, enough education to rise above it. So we have on the Skeptic's Guide webpage, we have our top 20 logical fallacies.
Very nice.
Because, you know, again, if you just really understand those logical fallacies, that's 99% of what you're going to encounter in the paranormal or pseudoscientific literature. You just go through and pick out the different logical fallacies. There's a very finite number of errors in thought that people make.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not that creative.
No, they're not. They're just, you know, mostly they're not that bright, is the bottom line. And then occasionally you get somebody, you know, like either Behe with intelligent design or Duisberg with HIV denial, somebody who has some intellectual capacity enough to, you know, get a PhD and succeed in a narrow field, but still their thinking is so muddled with illogic or emotion that it does not save them from embracing utter nonsense.
Right. Well, I mean, another HIV denier, Carrie Mullis, who, you know, won a Nobel Prize for invention of the PCR reaction. You know, he wrote an autobiography, I guess, and, you know, talks about, you know, astrology and all these other things that he believes in that are, you know, exactly the opposite of what you guys would promote. And so, yeah, I mean, it's funny how you can isolate those things. You know, you can do your science over here, but then have all these other, you know, nutty ideas.
Right.
Or other things.
Advanced degrees don't make you immuno to illogic. Yeah. That's
right.
Don't make you autoimmune to.
Autoimmune to. Right, absolutely. We were talking about James Randi a little bit earlier in this episode, and he loves ranting against PhDs who are full of absolute nonsense. Because, you know, partly because, you know, he's not an academician by training, but he has a different skill set. Yeah, he's a magician, obviously a very bright guy, very intelligent. He completely understands the foibles of human thought and how easy it is to deceive others and how easily we deceive ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that skill set applies itself much better to this whole field of pseudoscience. So he's often pitted against people who are maybe very accomplished scientists, but don't know the first thing about deception, and they fall utterly either under the sway or just duped by childish, you know, childish deception. And so he delights in exposing them, of course. But
Tara, I was wondering, I'm interested in antibiotics and kind of the direction that that antibiotic usage is going, is seems to be leading to. It's just very frightening to me that we could enter a pre-antibiotic era again with all the overuse and misuse that people are, in the way that people use it. I've got I'm just kind of interested in your thoughts on that, and I'm actually interested in a specific a specific idea that a doctor came up with that I think is a great type of antibiotic that maybe you've heard of it. It's called cyclic antibiotic peptides.
Peptide antibiotics, like the ones from our own skin and things like that?
Well, it's very novel. It's really not a chemical attack. It's more of a mechanical attack against bacteria.
Poking holes in it, essentially.
Yeah, right. It basically takes these rings of amino acids. They join up kind of like a rolled-up carpet and create a hole in the membrane of the bacteria, and within 15 or 20 seconds, it's dead. I was wondering if you were familiar with this. If you think, is this guy a crackpot? The doctor's name, by the way, is, let's see, M. Reza Gadiri, and it just seems so promising.
I'm not familiar with that name, but it sounds like, and I'm not sure exactly what he's written about it, but we do all have antibiotics on our skin, in a wide variety of animals, and other species, that are these peptide antibiotics. They do exactly, you know, what you say. They generally make little holes in the bacteria or something like that, kill them quickly, and it's part of our innate immune defense.
Oh, wow.
Before our B cells, before our T cells, before any of that adaptive stuff, you know, they're just on our skin to help help us fend off bacteria. So there was kind of an argument about this, about the evolution of resistance to these. And they actually did some studies that I wrote about on my blog before. It was several months ago. And one professor who had been interested in developing these as an antibiotic said, you know, the same thing that you said, that because there would have to be such a change, it would be unlikely that antibiotic resistance would develop. So another professor said, well, I'll take you up on that challenge. You know, let's do some experiments and let's see. So they did that. They took Pseudomonas aeruginosa, and I think they did another species of bacteria. I can't remember offhand. But and then they, you know, dosed them with these peptides, you know, started out at a low concentration and steadily raised it. And they found that, you know, indeed they did develop resistance to these. So I think it's an interesting idea and it's definitely a possibility, but we have to be careful. You know, this is something that is really an ancient defense. You know, it's widely distributed throughout the animal kingdom. So it's something that happened, you know, millions of years back in our evolution. So we don't want to lose that. that's even more important than, you know, the chemical antibiotics that we have now. So
I didn't know it was a natural defense that's that already existed. I thought it was
that's really what they based it on.
Okay.
So what you're saying is if we develop a pharmaceutical antibiotic that's based upon this principle and bacteria develop resistance to that, they'll also be developing resistance to our natural, you know, skin level resistance to these bacteria.
Right.
That would be a bad thing.
Yes, it would. And that's the fear of using it. I mean, but, you know, as was mentioned, there are a number of different, you know, permutations kind of these peptide antibiotics. So it may be possible to find one that's not present, you know, either in our repertoire or in nature or something, you know, that we could use and maybe that perhaps they can't develop resistance to or something. But it's something you want to do a lot of testing and a lot of searching for before you kind of jump in with both feet.
Yeah. What's your sense about Bob's first question, which is, do you think we're heading into an era where we're just going to be overwhelmed with resistant bacteria and it will be almost like the pre-antibiotic era where there are lots of infections we don't have any effective treatments for?
Well, I mean, we're definitely heading there with Staph aureus.
Yeah.
You know, right now, before
40,000 people a year die from it.
Yeah. I mean, before it was a problem in hospitals where we had these methicillin-resistant strains. Now they're widespread in the community. You know, we've had a couple strains that are resistant to vancomycin, which is kind of that antibiotic of last defense.
Right.
You know, and then it's strange because we have some bacteria that are still, you know, very very susceptible to even penicillin. You know, the strep species are mostly susceptible to penicillin, with the exception of strep pneumo. So I think it's really on a kind of a bacteria by bacteria basis.
Right.
And some certainly are winning that race. They're almost there. You know, and we're not cranking out antibiotics at anything close to the rate that we're going to need them. So it's definitely a concern. But the good thing is that, you know, even when I was in undergrad, there was almost, you know, or at least it seemed to me, that there was no concern in the medical field for this. You know, this is kind of when Stuart Levy was really pushing that, you know, this is a problem and we need to address overuse of antibiotics. We need to address antibiotics in agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like in the past decade that that's at least become, you know, people have become aware of it. So I guess that's a start.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a huge awareness of it in the medical community. And there's been a move away from, you know, using antibiotics for probable viral infections, like ear infections, et cetera.
Oh, my God, yeah.
And, you know, using specific antibiotics whenever possible and you know,
finishing
really
your course of medicine. You know, people, I just had a friend at work, I couldn't believe it. He said that he went on a course of antibiotics. He felt better like halfway through and stopped taking it.
That's the classic thing.
You know, I just said you're just speeding up the evolution of these nasty bugs that are the antibiotics won't help on. And one of my pet peeves, I remember like last year I went looking for just a normal hand soap, like this pump soap.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't want to buy, you know, the stuff that kills bacteria, you know, the stuff that's, you know, the bacteria killing soap, because you don't want to kill bacteria indiscriminately. There's so many of them that are good. If you kill off good bacteria, you know, what's going to take its place? You know, so, and I couldn't find one pump soap that didn't kill bacteria. It's like it proliferated everywhere, and now you can't even find the normal stuff anymore. And people don't realize that, you know, there's so many good bacteria out there. I mean, we could not live without them. I mean, your body, I mean, I read a figure once that astounded me. Your body is some crazy percentage bacteria. It's not even you. It's like 40.
By cell number, you're about 10 times more bacteria than eukaryotic cells.
I know, and people have this innate fear of them, an innate fear of insects or bugs. They just think that bacteria are bad, get rid of all bacteria. Yeah. They don't realize
they're all little and squirmily.
there's such a push for everything to be sterile now. You know, you have to have sterile countertops and sterile bathrooms and sterile kids' toys, and I mean, everything has to be sprayed with Lysol every time after you touch it. And it's crazy.
Yeah, it's also not only do we run the risk of, you know, perhaps killing off too many of our good bacteria that actually help us fight off infection, that it also our immune systems want to be stimulated on a regular basis. You know, every time you get exposed to a little bit of bacteria, it actually helps keep our immune system active and healthy. If you lived in a truly, you know, pristine, sterile environment, you wouldn't have good resistance to disease.
Yeah.
So,
that's about in the form of, you know, the hygiene hypothesis for reasons why there's all this, you know, childhood asthma and allergies, is that people are, you know, cleaning too much, and these kids aren't getting exposed. You know, they're not making mud pies and playing in the dirt like kids used to do it.
Right.
You know, maybe it's taking a toll on us. Who knows?
Well, Tara, thanks again for joining us on the Skeptic's Guide. We really appreciate it.
Oh, very happy to be here. Thank you.
This is very short notice. And we'd love to have you on again sometime in the future.
Oh,
good luck with the Iowans for Science.
Thank you so much.
Take care, Tara.
You, Tara.
Thank you.
Well, that was great having Tara Smith on the show, our first female skeptic on the show.
Yay.
What'd you guys think of her?
Awesome.
She was awesome.
Very good.
Wow, very good.
Definitely have to get her back.
Check out her website. She's a hottie. There's a picture of her. Sorry, I had to say it. It's the truth. It's the truth. And highly intelligent and motivated. I hope she does get more involved, Steve. In your end of the business there.
Yeah, she said she's interested in alternative medicine. There's definitely room for young, enthusiastic people to be active in that. So we have a few minutes left. I do have a science or fiction for this week, so why don't we finish up this week with science or fiction? Again, the rules are that we've sort of been rotating the duties. Perry did his first one last time. Bob's done a couple. And I've
stumped them all, by the way, last week.
You did. You cheated, but you did stump us all.
Yeah. I shaded.
But,
difference. Cheat, shade.
So how science or fiction works, I will come up with three science facts or news items. Two of them are true or real, and one I made up. Now, we talked a lot this week about denial, so I thought that the science or fiction would follow that theme. So the theme for this week is Holocaust denial. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to give you three claims that are made by the Holocaust deniers, also known as historical revisionists. Two of these claims that they make are actually true. These are all
true
claims that they make. So that what is true is that these are all claims that are made by prominent Holocaust deniers. But only two of them are actually correct. One of the claims is false. Okay, you ready? So claim number one. There is no evidence that Adolf Hitler ever ordered the final solution, or the extermination of all Jews in Europe. Number two. There is no physical proof or documentation of the existence of gas chambers at Nazi concentration camps. And number three, the claim that the Nazis mass-produced soap from the remains of concentration camp victims was a wartime propaganda lie. Again, those are three claims made by Holocaust deniers. Two of them are actually true.
I'll go first.
Okay, go ahead, Perry.
The first one I believe is true. The main decision for the final dissolution happened at the Wannsee Conference. Hitler was not present. So the first one, I believe, is accurate.
Okay.
The third one, I believe, is also accurate. I think that, I don't think they mass-produced soap out of it. I mean, there may have been an incident or something, just like the lampshades. I think that the second one, however, that there's no evidence of gas chambers at the camps is completely false. I think that there is both archaeological and, a great deal of eyewitness testimony. But particularly, I believe there's archaeological evidence.
Right. Again, eyewitness testimony is not part of the question. It's physical proof and documentation, not testimony.
Just to be clear,
because you said that.
Oh, very good. Well, I think there's
okay, but fine. Number two is your answer.
That's correct.
Evan, why don't you go next?
Number two is my answer as well, for the exact same reasons that Perry gave.
Okay.
I think Hitler only verbally referred to a final solution, and no documents or anything with his signature or name is on there. That links him in writing to that term, final solution, and. And the soap, and like Perry also mentioned, the lampshades comment. I've certainly heard that bantered about before, but I don't think there's any truth to that. That does sound like mythology to me. It's nothing I've ever read about. Yet, gas chambers, absolutely. In fact, I think we had someone came in to lecture for us several years ago for the New England Skeptical Society. And, specifically talked about Holocaust denial and,
right.
Talked specifically about the gas chamber evidence. So the second one is my choice.
Okay. Bob, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't have too much more to add than what Perry and Evan added. I'm almost positive that there was no physical evidence that Hitler ordered the final solution, just said it was a kind of, he talked about it, but nothing actually written down, no documentation. The soap one, I remember hearing that growing up, and I believed it, but I do not recall any evidence ever introduced to support that. So the fact that that might really be a myth is not surprising. But the gas chambers, I mean, I've heard and read stuff about it.
Right.
And I don't actually remember specifics, but I know that I'm almost positive there's evidence. For that kind of thing, actually on site and documentation. So, but then again, this seems almost too easy, Steve. But read the second one again. Exactly. What did you say earlier?
There is no physical. The second one is there is no physical proof or documentation of the existence of gas chambers at Nazi concentration camps.
All right, I'll stick with it too. It's definitely.
All right.
It.
Now, this one was easy. You guys all got it right. You guys are very well educated on Holocaust denial. I figured it would be easy. This is one a little bit more for the audience. So, just to go over them, the first one, you guys are right. I mean, Adolf Hitler spoke in many of his speeches about eradicating the Jews from Germany and eradicating them. He used the term Ausrotten, which translates to rip out by the roots the Jews from Europe. But he never signed an order, you know, saying systematically, you know, murder them in concentration camps. There's no, and, again, it points to the fact that the Holocaust was not one order, one event, one thing. It was a complex compilation of events that occurred and evolved over years. You know, it kind of just developed over time out of the philosophy and the intent of the Nazis and of Hitler. But the Holocaust deniers sort of use the lack of simplistic sort of smoking gun effort evidence as an argument that it was never the intention of the Nazis to kill all the Jews. Number three is also one. Again, Bob, you're right. I mean, I heard that growing up, too. It was just sort of part of the Holocaust lore. Yeah, they made soap and lampshades out of the victims. In fact, they never made any soap out of anybody. There's no evidence for that at all. Interestingly, the Holocaust deniers are correct in that claim that was in fact a propaganda that was started at the time of World War II, and in fact lingered on even into modern times. People, I think, still believe that, but it really was just wartime propaganda. But what they say is that Holocaust historians have been forced to back away from the claim that the Nazis made soap out of the concentration camp victims because of the evidence presented by the revisionists. That is, in fact, not true. The historians have never claimed that victims were made into soap. That was never claimed by any historian. It only ever was just some superficial propaganda.
Talk about unnecessary propaganda.
Right. It wasn't bad enough.
Right. But those kind of things,
I don't know that it was conscious propaganda. It's just one of those things that sort of spontaneously, like a rumor that just takes on a life of its own. The other thing, a couple of you brought up the lampshades. I didn't put that in there, but in fact, the lampshades were a little bit different. There were a few artifacts recovered that, in fact, did...
I've seen them on television.
Yes,
they were all fake.
Nope, they're genuine. Yeah. They actually contain human skin, forensically proven. A book bound in human skin as leather, a couple of lampshades. But there was no mass production of these. It was just a few items that were recovered. I believe they were in the possession of a woman. Her name is K-O-C-H, and I believe it's pronounced Koch, is the way her name is pronounced in German. But those were real, but the scope of that was very, 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 very small. That was just one individual, apparently. The Holocaust deniers actually claim that there's no evidence that the gas chambers existed. And they, again, take a lot of quotes out of context and, you know, misinterpret data or just, you know, make claims like, well, if there were gas chambers, why aren't there aerial photos showing the gas? Whatever. They just arbitrarily decide what evidence they think there should be.
Satellite photos.
Yeah, when there are satellite photos. And they ignore the evidence that is there. I mean, the buildings are there. Some of them, you know, in some of the camps where the Nazis had time, they destroyed the camps before they were taken over. You know, I don't know why they bothered, but they did. In some places all we have left is one wall where the gas chamber used to be. A lot of the evidence is eyewitness testimony, in which they happily dismiss. But there is enough, there are drawings, there are documentation of the schematics of certain, of some of the gas chambers, although not a lot. I mean, there is a lot of their construction, etc., is shrouded in sort of poor documentation, in the mists of history, as they say. And again, all of that, the lack of evidence is sort of trumped by the deniers to say that they didn't really exist. But there is more than adequate documentation of physical evidence. Less than you may think, but it's there to prove that they, in fact, did exist.
The Nazis worked very, very hard to hide what they did.
Yeah, they did.
You know, with the power of the entire state behind them, they worked very hard to hide it.
They did destroy a lot of the buildings that were used, a lot of the evidence, and although you know, we did capture some of the camps, you know, with still you know victims alive in the camp, you know, just as the Nazis were in retreat, they didn't have the time to completely cover their tracks. So you guys, you've paid attention during our lectures on the Holocaust denial. You guys remember those details. That's all very good. So that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks again for joining us, guys. Bob, Evan, Perry.
Thank you, Doug.
Excellent.
Our pleasure.
We'll see you all next week.
Good
always,
episode.
Always good to talk to you guys. Until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is a production of the New England Skeptical Society. For more information about this and other episodes, visit our website at www.thenes.com. Theorem is performed by Kenno and is used with permission.
Last theorem, led him far from the mainstream. Sleepless nights, slow burn days, problems, proofs, endless delays. Oh,